We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Well, these days in Washington, one of the big topics for debate and conversation is reform of the nation's healthcare system. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about the need for reform in another area of healthcare, an area that I'm sure our guest and other people would argue just doesn't get the amount of attention that it should. And here we're talking about mental health care. Our guest for the program is Timothy Kelly. He's director of the Dupree Center Public Policy Institute, associate professor of psychology at the Fuller Graduate School of Psychology in Pasadena, California, and he is also former commissioner of Virginia's Department of Mental Health, Mental Retardation, and Substance Abuse Services. He is the author of a book that we'll be talking about. The title is Healing the Broken Mind, Transforming America's Failed Mental Health System. It's published by the New York University Press. And in the book, he makes the observation that we've certainly come a very long way in our understanding of mental illness and in our ability to treat it. Sadly, though, he says, there are many, many people across the country struggling with mental illness who are unable to find effective quality treatment. In fact, and I'm sure we'll talk some more about this, he references a 2003 report from a presidential commission on mental health. It says this commission concluded that America's mental health delivery system was in a shambles and needed dramatic reform. Well, we'll talk a little bit about the system as it is and some of the reforms that our guest has in mind. And of course, if you're interested in calling in and joining the conversation, you can do that. We just ask people to stay on the topic if they can and keep their comments brief so we can get in as many callers as possible. But callers are certainly invited. 333-9455. That's the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-9455. Locally, toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point, your questions, comments are welcome. Dr. Kelly, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Just to start out, I guess, as you do in the book, I'd ask you to talk a little bit about some of your experiences that you had when you were the commissioner of mental health, the mental health department there in Virginia.
Sure.
Your interest in this area, I know, goes back at least that far, and you've been working in mental health for a long time, but you make some observations about the system there in Virginia that you saw, the kind of thing that, as you explained, probably most people aren't going to see, but in your role as the commissioner, you saw.
Yes, and let me just begin by saying I really appreciate your interest in the topic. As you said in your opening comments, the plight of people who struggle with mental illness is something that we tend to overlook. And those of us who have been in the system of care know that there are just so many heartbreaking stories of men and women, youth, children even, who struggle with serious mental illness, sometimes to the point of or even including suicide attempts. And many of them just long to be able to have a successful, productive life in the home community, and that should be possible. The trouble is our system of care is frankly broken. It's broken enough so that most people who struggle with serious mental illness just aren't able to go home. They're not able to live a normal, productive life in the home community. And that's really what drives this book. That's really what drives my passion about this. It's a heartbreak, a tragedy that need not be. So I've been in the field, for a long time. I started in the early 70s. So I've been in the field of mental health care in some form or fashion for almost 40 years now. And in the book, I mentioned that it's interesting. I happened to grow up, part of my childhood was in Lynchburg, Virginia, where there's a huge facility for mental retardation. And as a child, and when I was 12 years old, I was in the Boy Scouts, and we were on parade through the grounds of that hospital for people with mental retardation. And I talk about in the book how frightening it was, because we would sort of march past these men in diapers behind big 10-foot chain-link fences watching us, and it was an awful scene. It was a little glimpse into how people were treated back then, which was 1963. It was the summer of 63. And it sort of indelibly impressed my mind at the time that there was something terribly wrong, not only with the people there, but with how we were treating the people there. Then I found myself appointed as commissioner of the Department of Mental Health, Mental Retardation, and Substance Abuse Services in the Commonwealth of Virginia in 1994, many, many years later. And that facility was still there. And so I talk in the book about how I was, felt like coming full circle somehow to come back to the facility in my commissioner's car and visit the organization and greet the staff. And things were much, much improved, of course. Nobody was in diapers. Everybody was fully clothed. There was a treatment program in place. Everything seemed pretty good. But as I note in the book, I found when I was commissioner that there's a great difference between what you see when you're on official tour and what you see when you just drop in unexpectedly. Virginia has 16 psychiatric facilities, and I made it a point of dropping in unexpectedly to each one. And whenever I did that, what I tended to find was we'd walk into a locked ward very quickly. It would have to be done quickly. I would typically sort of surprise the facility director and then ask for someone to bring the keys, and we go straight on to the locked wards. Typically what you find is people sitting around on couches watching TV, staff and patients alike, what we call custodial care. And the trouble with that is what that boils down to is people are just waiting for their meds to kick in, for the medications to kick in. Then as soon as they're stabilized, they're discharged to the home community. The follow-up care in the community is often well-intentioned, but usually not enough and not effective enough. And then the person will sort of spiral down and eventually crash and burn and be rehospitalized. So that's this vicious cycle, you see, that we're caught in our current system of care, mm-hmm. that people are hospitalized, they're stabilized, they're discharged to the home community, they spiral down, they decompensate, then they're rehospitalized. And that vicious cycle of care is very costly on the individual, as you can imagine. It's even costly on the system. It's expensive to provide treatment that way. So my book basically is calling for a total redesign of the system of care. Instead of being based on hospitalization and then discharge to minimal community care, it should be a home and community-based system of care, marked by innovation, marked by evidence-based practices, marked by outcome-oriented measures that would be in place to assure quality of care and accountability.
Mm. And just to come back to, and in a sense, underscore a point that you made initially when you first started to respond to my introduction. Well, it's true. I'm sure it's true to say that our understanding of mental illness is incomplete. Uh-huh. You would say that we really have a lot to offer to people for treatment to make it possible for many people to function. And certainly not require institutionalization. So it's not that we don't know how. That's not the issue.
No, and that's an excellent point. We do understand a great deal about mental disorders, mental illness. We can define it. We can classify it. We can screen for it. We have treatments. The treatments include both psychotherapy and medication, as well as supports in the home community. We know how to provide services and care for people even with serious mental illness so that they can recover. Recovery is sort of the goal now, and that's the appropriate goal. Recovery doesn't mean, by the way, perfect healing, but it means that even if you're struggling with major recurrent depression or bipolar disorder or even schizophrenia, it is possible through effective treatment to get what you need so that you can succeed in the home community. You can have a real home, a fulfilling job, deep relationships. We have all this available. It's just that the structure that's in place, and you realize the structure that's in place is driven primarily by reimbursement mechanisms. In other words, what we have in place is what people will pay for. So it's hard to change that. Right now, what's reimbursed is the current status quo system of care. And a lot of people benefit from that. It's about $100 billion a year that's flowing through that system. And so what we're finding, those of us who have been pushing for reforms, and I'm not the only one, there's dozens of us who are sort of reform-oriented, what we're finding is that there's a tremendous kickback from the status quo. It's not from the people who are struggling with mental illness. It's more from the provider system.
And just one other point again to make, you know, as I said in the beginning, now there is this big debate going on in Washington about reform of health care, something that I'm sure a lot of people would say was overdue.
Right.
And it in part is intended to address the problem that we have tens of millions of people who don't have health insurance and a lot of people who don't have access to care or limited access to care. And I think that at all along, as people have been talking about that kind of issue, there have been some people saying, and we have another big issue here too, and that has to do with access to mental health services. And what's now being talked about in Washington to try to get it at healthcare access issues, that doesn't do anything about this other kind of problem.
Right, except thankfully, there are a lot of people in D.C., and myself as well, who've been knocking on doors there and trying to make sure that mental health issues are addressed in healthcare reform. So currently, there's some interesting developments. Patrick Kennedy's office, you know, the congressman there, is very interested in mental health care reform, and I gave them an early copy of my book, and they have adopted a piece of it that has to do with changing medical necessity to clinical necessity, which in a nutshell means that when you're treating someone for a mental illness, you need to be able to treat them for prevention and follow-up care as well. Also, if you read the current healthcare proposal, it does include a couple of things that are very important. It includes the concept of parity coverage for mental health care, which means that if your insurance policy gives you 2 weeks of hospitalization for medical or surgical needs, it ought to give you 2 weeks for mental health needs as well, if needed. Mm-hmm. And it also includes the concept of integrating mental health and health care, so that the notion would be that if you go to see a doctor and maybe you're having stomach ulcers or something like that, but it's clear you're also struggling from depression, you can just walk down the hall and meet with someone who can screen you for depression. So there's some pieces of mental health reform that are already in the healthcare legislation. I would argue not enough, but at least there's some steps in the right direction.
How much, I wonder, is this complicated by the fact that mental illness is something that's frightening for a lot of people, maybe for most people, and not so much, I think, that they're afraid of people who are mentally ill, although I think also for some people they may not articulate it this way, but it's almost as if they're afraid that it's catching, you know, that that it was contagious, that simply by being with somebody who was mentally ill, they would get mental illness. But I don't know if it's so specifically directed at people who are mentally ill as it is mental illness in general, and the idea of it just being something frightening, and because it's frightening, we just rather not think about it.
I think that's exactly right, and it's a tremendous problem that we have to try to overcome, and that is what we might call the stigmatization of mental illness. And because it's stigmatizing, because it can be scary, we do tend to sort of sweep it under the rug. And yet, survey after survey after survey have shown that almost all of us know somebody who has struggled with mental illness or even serious mental illness, and of course many of us have experienced that as well. And so it might help a little for the sake of your listeners if I talk a little bit about the definition of mental illness.
Sure.
Because you make a good point. It's not something that you can catch because it's not driven by any kind of a pathogen. The best definition, I think, has to do with what's usually called a biopsychosocial perspective. And what that means is it involves biology, psychology, and some sort of a social event which creates mental illness. And it goes something like this. We're all born, biologically, that is, genetically, with various vulnerabilities. Some of us are vulnerable to ulcers. Some of us are vulnerable to diabetes. Some of us are vulnerable to mental disorders. And vulnerabilities are something that's just part and parcel of being a human being. You know, we all have them, both physical and mental. Then the psychological component has to do with sometimes how we were brought up, the way we learn to think and process and feel things, especially, for instance, those of us who have learned to think rather negatively, especially about ourselves, we can see now that, that gives us a bit of a predisposition towards depression, for instance. And then usually there's a social component as well, and typically that can be a trauma or a loss, some event of some sort that triggers the mental illness. So we say there's a biopsychosocial etiology or background to mental illness that any of us can experience. And when you have the perfect storm of those three together, then any of us can experience depression, panic attacks, bipolar disorder, even schizophrenia.
Let me very quickly introduce again our guest, Dr. Timothy Kelly. He's director of the Dupree Center Public Policy Institute and also associate professor of psychology at the Fuller Graduate School of Psychology in Pasadena, California, and someone who has worked in the mental health field for many years. He's former commissioner of Virginia's Department of Mental Health, Mental Retardation, and Substance Abuse Services. He's also served on the boards of directors of the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors and also the National Research Institute, and he is the author of the book Healing the Broken Mind. The subtitle is Transforming America's Failed Mental Health System, in which he takes a look at the system and has some things to say about how it could be made to function better. That's published by the New York University Press. Questions, comments are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455.
David, can I just make a comment?
Yes, yes.
To me, and what we're hitting at here and what my book is trying to hit at, is the real tragedy of all this. It's not that mental illness really is such a difficult thing to understand or to treat. It's simply part and parcel of being a human being, just like physical illness is. It's just part of living in this crazy old world of ours. There's no reason why we should sweep that under the rug. But the trouble is, by sweeping it under the rug and by offering treatments and services that are particularly ineffective, even if costly, the result is a whole lot of people, our friends, neighbors, and family members all across America, who struggle and suffer incredibly with mental illness all their life, when it need not be that way. It would be possible to offer treatments and services so that the vast majority of them could recover to the point of being able to live successfully, productively in the home community. So it's a tragedy and a waste, and it's even unnecessarily expensive.
We now have some good medications that, with relatively minimum side effects, can help treat symptoms of mental illness to the point where many people who previously might have found their symptoms debilitating can make it possible for them to function. The problem, though, it seems, is because the etiology is complex, as you say, that if what we do is we take people out of the environment that has contributed to the problem and we give them some medication to help with their symptoms, but if then we don't do anything else, we put them right, they go back to the life they were leading before, that we really haven't gotten at the problem because we've just kind of papered over it by dampening down the people's symptoms. But there is this more complete picture that would have to be part of the treatment. And it seems, though, that that's much more difficult. It would take more time. It would be more expensive. And there maybe you also get into more questions about what sort of treatment methods are truly effective.
Right. Now, you've hit several nails on the head, and I just want to concur with that. Another way to put it is that we do have good medications to help with most of the mental disorders, not all of them. There is a tendency, though, for us to want to see the solution in a pill and to overprescribe. Let me give you an example. I ran a clinic, a mental health clinic, in the Washington, D.C. area for several years, and I'm going to give you an example. It's kind of a composite, but it's pretty typical. I worked with a woman, a teacher who was in her 20s, who was struggling with bipolar disorder. And when she was in the manic phase of the bipolar disorder, she did some things that were harmful to herself and ended up hospitalized. So in the hospital, they put her on stabilizing medication, lithium and perhaps some other meds that would stabilize the mood, and then discharged her. So she's now on one medication, and that does seem to help for the manic part of the bipolar disorder. But then when she goes in to get her meds check, her check on medication 1 month later, they determine that she's feeling a little bit depressed, and so they put her on an antidepressant as well, an SSRI antidepressant. So now she's on two medications. Then a month later, she goes back in, and she says she's having a little trouble sleeping, so they put her on a hypnotic or an anti-anxiety medication to help with that. Every time she went back, she got a different medication for a different symptom. Finally, she's on four or five medications, and the interaction effect alone of those four or five medications drives you bonkers. And she ended up decompensating and being rehospitalized. So one of the things I address in my book is we must not over-rely on medications. They do need to be used, just like hospitalization does need to be a part of the treatment system. But we tend to over-rely on it, and that means that people typically are discharged over-medicated and managing the symptoms that come with that, and eventually get fed up with it. And many of them become non-compliant, and we wonder why. So they stop taking their meds, and then everything cycles back through again.
Well, it seems then what one of the things, at least one of the things that we're talking about here, is the real need to be able to have people have more access to more outpatient counseling, therapy, time with someone. And the problem there is perhaps twofold. It's, do we have the people to provide those services? And then how do we pay for those services?
Yes, although it turns out that the more effective approach to this, which is a sort of a home and community-based approach to treatment, in the long run would be less expensive because it wouldn't rely on that, have such a heavy reliance on hospitalization or medication. Mm-hmm. But let me give you an example of what we're talking about then, what we want to move towards. When I was commissioner in Virginia, we had some new money to put into the system, and so we tested something that's called the Program for Assertive Community Treatment, PACT, and that's designed to help people who have the most serious types of mental illness, for instance, paranoid schizophrenia that's chronic and recurring, the type of people who without help, will often end up on the street, and we call them, you know, the homeless mentally ill. This program basically tells the mental health providers to get out from behind their desk. Don't just rely on people being committed and coming into the hospital to see you. Don't even just rely on the outpatient side on people coming in to see you 50 minutes once a week. But rather, get yourself out in the home community. And maybe there's a need to check in and be a little bit of help with someone who's at home having a conflict with a family member. Or maybe they need a modification of their prescription at an unusual hour. Or maybe they need help working things out with a boss. Or maybe there's school issues. The point being that the most effective approach to mental health treatment is where people live, not having those people come in to see you on an occasional basis. And that's doable. We found that it was quite successful, and Virginia then expanded that program, I'm thankful to say. And I believe it's done so with good success.
All right. We have a couple of callers here. Why don't we talk to them, starting with someone in Champaign on our line one. Hello.
Hi. Great topic. Here in Illinois, we have had the community implementation starting in the 70s, and certainly I was a outreach social worker for 10 years, 1990 to 2000. So at least here in Illinois, we already have a heavy implementation of the community-based outreach and treatment.
Right.
The issues that I see predominantly here always come down to two issues. First of all, freedom of choice by the people who may or may not want to receive mental health services, and then funding for services is the biggest gap. And I say the freedom of choice is a huge issue because as somebody who was, again, a community outreach worker and a crisis worker for 3 years, doing, you know, mental health assessment on the hospital and where people are coming in seeking services and we're trying to deflect them and get them with the best services unless they absolutely need to be in the hospital.
Right.
Frequently, the issue is the person's choice. They choose to see a GP who may or may not be the best person.
Right.
They choose to see doc only, even though we're pushing counseling, because, of course, it's pretty well established that co-occurring treatment of cognitive behavioral therapy and medication is the most effective unless somebody has some real functional deficits, then they need some you know, I forget the model now, psychosocial rehab was what they were calling it, the Boston model of community intervention. So I see that freedom of choice as being the biggest issue, especially the impact of substance abuse. But the real issue here in Illinois is our budget is going to crash and burn. Already this month, we have community service providers who are going to close, okay, because the state just, our state has a history of not wanting to raise taxes and not wanting to pay bills. So not only do we have a lack of Medicaid parity where mental health providers receive a quarter of what they charge, the state is not paying bills. So it's very likely that we are going to see all the community supports that we do have crash and burn. So those are the two issues that I see, the freedom of choice and then the lack of societal investment in providing these wider options, especially for individuals who do have functional deficits and need that wider range of support. So I'm glad you're talking about it, because if we don't talk about it, nobody learns about it. So I'll just kick off and listen to you.
Thanks for the call.
Well, you raised two excellent points, you know, both the funding and the freedom of choice issue. The funding issue is trickier than you'd think. I totally agree with the caller that if we do not adequately fund mental health services, then we can't be surprised when they don't work very well. They're not effective. We clearly need to adequately fund care. There is another side to that coin, though. Here in California, a couple of years ago, we passed a proposition, Proposition 63, which put an extra 1% tax on anybody earning more than $1 million for the sake of mental health care. And this was to add to the mental health system here in California, and it did so. More than $1 billion a year was raised, and this on top of the current mental health care budget. So all of a sudden, we as a state had some serious money to work with, and the Department of Mental Health correctly decided to use that money to fund innovative, effective home and community-based systems, treatments that were evidence-based, based on science, the types of things that we're calling for in my book. And tried very hard to get the system to move in that way. And here we are a couple of years later, and I got to tell you, it's been really, really difficult to do that. There's this great tendency to use whatever money's come into the system to support and to build and to expand the status quo, whether it's particularly effective or not. So to my way of thinking, we would do best if when we're calling for new funds, we also stipulate that those new funds will be used for effective treatments, evidence-based care, approaches to psychotherapy or to use of medication that can be shown on the basis of good research to be effective for people struggling with depression or panic disorder or whatever the disorder might be. So that's the one point on the funding issue is I think we'll find that third-party payers, whether that's government or private sector, are more likely to at least consider increasing funding to levels that we should attain if there's some assurance that what they're getting is effective, will work, that it's efficient, that as a result people will in fact recover. Then the second question was the freedom of choice, and the caller didn't mention the term, but one of the things that comes up in my book and I try to address is the issue of commitment law. What's the line that has to be crossed for society to determine whether or not someone needs treatment? And that's a national conversation that we're struggling with. In the book, I just point out that you can err either way. If the commitment laws, that is, the laws that are in place and basically prescribe treatment for someone, if the barrier is too low, then we have people being pulled into the system against their will, and that's not helpful. If it's too high, though, we have people who are very ill who don't get the care that they need, and often it's family members of people with serious mental illness will point that out. Well, they'll say, well, it's terrible. I have to wait until my brother is a threat of harm to self or someone else before anybody will take notice of him. So there is a need to fine-tune the commitment laws that our states have. And then beyond that, I think the caller also raised the question of, you know, people who just would much rather see their issues in terms of medical illnesses rather than mental health illnesses, and that gets back to the stigma thing. So there's a kind of a vicious cycle here as well. We have to break the stigma. We have to make it okay to say, hey, I'm going in for some counseling because I think it's the resource that I need right now. And if we can move in that direction, people will be more likely to seek help when they need help with a mental disorder of some sort. And on that point, the health care legislation that's moving through has done something very helpful by trying to reintegrate resources for health care and mental health care. In other words, it would be easier to do that if instead of being referred to the psychiatrist at the psychiatric hospital, if you're just walking down the hall to a psychologist or psychiatrist who works with your MD.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Timothy Kelly. He is Associate Professor of Psychology at the Fuller Graduate School of Psychology in Pasadena, California. He's also Director of the Dupree Center Public Policy Institute and is a former Commissioner of Virginia's Department of Mental Health, Mental Retardation, and Substance Abuse Services. He's been working in the mental health field for a number of years now, and he's author of the book Healing the Broken Mind, Transforming America's Failed Mental Health System. It's published by the New York University Press. We have another caller.
Can I make just one more caveat?
Sure.
I meant to make it earlier on, but it's important. You know, by necessity, I'm focusing in this conversation and in my book on what's wrong with the system, because the desire is to correct what's wrong so that more people can recover. I don't want to give the false impression that there's not good people, good treatments, good programs out there. It's really important to note that, and I do so in the book. I just want to say so here. Even though I point out that it's the provider system that's resisting reform, which is true, well, I'm a provider too. And so there are many, many dedicated, big-hearted, effective mental health providers, psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, and others rolling up their sleeves and doing a great job out there. It's just that the system, as a system, especially the reimbursement structures built into the system, the inertia of the status quo, that's what the real enemy is. That's what we've got to struggle against.
All right. Let's talk with someone else in Effingham on our line four.
Yes. Thank you, David. A wonderful program. I had a couple of questions. First, I watched for almost 3 hours on C-SPAN Sunday afternoon this lady who had been autistic. But she had great parenting from her stepfather and her mother, and I just can't remember. I couldn't find my notes, but it was she had become got her doctoral degree from the University of Illinois, and in the field of addressing autism and functioning. And her demeanor was obvious that she had had those problems. But she worked with pictures in her mind. You'd ask her a question, and she would have to rifle through the pictures, and then she could answer brilliantly any questions or things that were posed to her. I don't know. I can't remember her name. It seemed like it was Elizabethan, something like that. But anyway, it was just, it addressed the very subjects, in her case, autism. But it was very timely, and I think a step forward for this. Have you heard of this lady?
I haven't heard of the lady, but I think your illustration makes an excellent point, because as I'm listening to you talk, I'm thinking, well, this woman has been able to recover well enough to function well.
Yes.
And that's the point. And that's certainly possible with autism. That's certainly possible with Asperger's. That's certainly possible with many of the serious mental disorders. And that's exactly what my book is trying to drive at. And that is that with a little, well, maybe even a lot, of creative, innovative, effective treatment and help and support and encouragement along the way, the vast majority of people who struggle with these disorders can recover. And by recover, we just mean, well, they're able to function well. And it sounds like that's what that one was able to do.
Oh, it was fantastic. And another thing, was it the 1970s or early 80s that all the institutions here in Illinois, I remember Lincoln facility that now is closed down, I think, for the most part, those people were removed from those institutions and put on the street and were victims of every sort of predator that one could think of. Their money was stolen, and I saw several programs there, I think, in the 80s about the condition of those people. And then I'll ask my last question. I'll ring off and not take up this much time. But if you had ever read or discovered the psychoanalyst Wilhelm Reich, I'll ring off and listen on the radio. Thank you.
No, I'm not familiar with that particular author, But I do want to go back to the next to the last point that the caller raised, which is an excellent one, which is, you know, we usually call it deinstitutionalization. You know, historically, in America, we built psychiatric hospitals up through the 50s and got to the point where we had over 500,000 Americans hospitalized for psychiatric disorders, a huge number of people. Then came the discovery of the antipsychotic medications like Haldol and Thorazine, and they helped people enough so that they could be discharged from the hospitals. And the census from psychiatric hospitals went down from over 500,000 to, I think, around 50,000 today, so only a tenth. And we call that deinstitutionalization. And it's been pointed out by many that deinstitutionalization has led to a host of problems. That is, people who have been discharged and, as the caller noted, have been exploited, end up on the street, end up not receiving the care they need. And that's a very tragic situation. But I want to make a point, which I also make in the book. Deinstitutionalization is the right idea. It was just wrongly implemented. It's right because we don't want people to have to live their lives hospitalized in a psychiatric hospital any more than they absolutely have to. There's a place and a role for inpatient care, but it should be rare and it should be short, except in the most rare situations. So what happened with deinstitutionalization was it was only halfway implemented. The other half of the coin was supposed to be effective home and community-based services to pick up the slack so that when people are discharged and they go home, they then work with professionals in the home community who provide what's needed for them to succeed. We did develop the community mental health system. I believe every county in America has a community mental health center now, a CMHC, in place. And again, in some of those, there are people doing wonderful work. But in too many, there's either not enough resources or the type of care that's offered is just not adequate, so that if a person comes back to the community and then they're referred to the CMHC, they just don't get what they need. But deinstitutionalization, from a policy perspective, is the right policy. It's just got to be correctly implemented. Mm.
Well, I don't forgive me for continuing to come back to the money issue, but I guess I do find myself wondering what really was the problem there with the community. The idea of community mental health, you say it was a good idea, and we actually moved in that direction, and we have community mental health centers. Was it just that we never, as a country, we never really provided adequate funding so that these centers could do what we were hoping that they would do?
You know, it would be, in fact, a simpler answer to be able to just say, yes, that's the only issue, is that we're underfunded. And we are, by and large, underfunded, and that's an issue that has to be addressed. But I have to say that's not the only problem. When I was commissioner in Virginia, I of course, dealt with this head-on, but the questions I would ask if someone came to me and said, I don't have enough funds to do what I want and need to do, I would say, okay, I'll help you. Let's work on that. But by the way, how well are you using the funds that you have? How effective are the treatments and services that you're providing? Are you embracing innovative new ideas? Are you using evidence-based practices as opposed to treatment approaches that people just happen to have been trained in? Are your people making sure that they're keeping up with the literature and learning the newer approaches to treatment that are coming along and that are you know, being promoted in the literature? Or is there sort of a comfortableness that settles in on the organization with business as usual, sort of the status quo, and then a sort of a knee-jerk reaction anytime something is pointed to and, you know, somebody raises a question to say, well, we're underfunded. So I'm not denying that there's a need to increase funding for mental health service delivery. But I think in order to do that, we also have to correct the other side of the coin, which is how effectively are we using the funds that we have? How effective are our services?
And that gets back to this, your point, your concern about whether or not treatment that's the kind of methods of treatment are being used are methods that have been demonstrated to work, and that you're saying that, in fact, we do know that there are treatments that have been demonstrated to work, and so that's what we really ought to be doing. I guess I'm wondering what exactly is the difference between I'm not sure if it's possible to even answer this question. What exactly is the difference between what works and what doesn't? I mean, is there a clear difference between what works and what doesn't?
Oh, absolutely. And by the way, to find out what works, we only have to ask some questions of the people who come to us for help. So let's say if someone comes into my clinic and they're struggling with major depression, it's really helpful to use a brief little survey that's scientifically sound that will measure three things. It measures the symptoms that brought the person in the first place, because if you think about it, what usually causes a person to seek help is the symptoms of a mental disorder. So if you're experiencing depression, the symptom might be, I find myself crying at least once a day. I find myself not being able to eat much. I'm losing weight. I don't sleep very well. My mind is unfocused, and I've even had thoughts of hurting myself, let's say. Those are five symptoms, and that would qualify you for what we would say is a diagnosis of depression. You want to track those symptoms. And if I'm providing effective care, I would want to be able to say to the person coming in, I want to be able to say, well, in a reasonable amount of time, those symptoms should remediate. Those symptoms should be going the right direction. So that's one thing, is to track and measure symptoms. The second thing is functionality, how well a person is functioning. Usually if you're struggling with mental illness, it does get in the way of how you're doing at home, at school, or at work. So you also want to address that, and you want to maybe ask a question regularly, how's it going? How are you doing at home, at work, or at school? And the expectation should be that with effective treatment, your ability to function will be improving steadily. And the last question would be, how satisfied are you with the care you're receiving? Now, if you cover those three areas, and you can do so pretty easily, regularly, you'll be able to see what's working and what isn't. And what's working is what helps people to recover fairly rapidly. If there's no recovery, then something's wrong. There should be a review of the treatment protocol, perhaps. But by the way, let me make an associated point here that I try to hit in the book as well. Mm. For this to work well, what we're talking about is taking the person who's coming to you for care more seriously. By the way, the field refers sometimes to people with mental illness who are in the system as consumers of mental health services. So one of the chapters in the books points out that we need a consumer-driven system of care. It should be that when you go in for care, you're able to sit down with your provider and have a discussion about what your options are and what you can expect and how long it'll take to get better. And you should have some input, some feedback into evaluation of your own care, as well as some input into to treatment decisions. So part of what's needed to transform the system of care is to include the people on whose behalf we have it there in the first place in decision-making, both in treatment and even in policy development and in evaluation of services.
Hmm. And why, I ask this question with this given that says that truly people can't, they have to be involved in their own care. They have to be involved in their own therapy to the extent that they can. They mm-hmm. have to be a partner with the physician. And I suppose that's true no matter what it is you're talking about. But
that's
here,
true in the healthcare system as well.
Yes, and that was the point I was stumbling toward. That doctors have to expect certain things of their patients to the extent that they can do those things.
Yeah, because collaborative care is more effective. All the research shows that, whether it's in healthcare or in mental healthcare, if you have a collaborative approach, rather than coming on as the authority who knows everything and who's not to be questioned, care will be more effective.
So if that has been lacking in mental health,
absolutely.
Why is that?
Well, that's part of the, the attitude that's built into our training programs, I guess. I would argue both in healthcare and mental health care. I don't know about you, when I go in if I've got a cold or something, I go in to see my doctor, who I like very much, by the way. He's a good guy. But I walk in, they put me in a little paper robe, and I sit in the room, and he comes in his white lab coat, and I have about 5 minutes to describe what I'm dealing with and for him to write a prescription and then to blow out the door again. Mm-hmm. I don't have time to say, well, doctor, are there alternatives here, and why is this happening so frequently, and, you know, I might want to try a new approach. Or, you know, you can't have that conversation. Same thing in mental health care. There's a tendency for us, doctor sorts, and I'm one of them, to feel like we've got the answers and the person needs to come in and basically cooperate with me so they'll get better. I think that's a bad attitude. One of the things I've started doing is when people come to me for care, and I'm a licensed practicing psychologist still, one of the things I say on the first visit is, you know, you might want to have a visit with one or two other people as well and see who you connect with the best. And I would suggest you want to work with whoever you connect with best, someone who will really understand what you're experiencing and who can hear you accurately and with whom you can do some good collaborative work. I just find that's a good thing to do. Almost all of them come back, and if they don't, that's okay too. But if they come back, then they've made a decision to work with you. And then you can sort of roll up your sleeves together and do what it takes to move towards recovery.
Yeah. And I guess that just, I realize we keep, in a sense, coming back to some of the same points. But there, again, I find myself thinking about the one problem here being the kind of structure within which healthcare in this country is delivered, which, whether you're talking about a physical problem or you're talking about a psychological problem, having adequate time with your doctor to talk about what's going on and to do anything more than just poke you a little bit, prod you a little bit, collect a few symptoms and try to figure out, well, what's the best way that we can treat that and dispense something and then good luck and put that person out the door. It seems like a problem across the board, and particularly with mental health, you really can't treat it that way.
No, and yet that's what often happens. You go in for your monthly 15 minutes meds check, and then you're bounced out again. And there's a related point here I want to make that's also covered in the book, and that is that mental health services tend to be monopolistic, whether that's state health care or even private sector. On the state side, if you qualify for treatment, there's often only one or a few providers that you can go to for help. You don't have the option of trying to find someone who is perhaps expert in what you need. You go to whoever might be there and funded by the state. And one of the recommendations I make is to open up the state health care system so that there's an array of providers for every type of care, so that there will be a natural competitive quality to this, and we providers will have to compete for the privilege of treating those who come to us. Then in the private sector, there's the issue of those limited array of providers who are preferred providers on the list that you get to work with. And there, too, it tends to have a sort of monopolistic impact. My book points out that the research shows that competition is good for quality of care. So there's a need to sort of work against the monopolistic tendencies in the mental health care system as well.
One more caller here at least. The person changed their mind. Other people, if you'd like to give us a call, 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a couple of minutes left with our guest, Dr. Timothy Kelly. He is Associate Professor of Psychology at the Fuller Graduate School of Psychology in Pasadena, California, and he is the author of the book Healing the Broken Mind, subtitled Transforming America's Failed Mental Health System, and it's published by the New York University Press. Well, I guess I want to come back to the possibility for this kind of reform, and you said at least that you were encouraged that as part of the whole big conversation about healthcare reform in the United States, there were a couple of things in there that dealt with mental health as a way of trying to integrate sort of what have been and continue to be two separate systems to try to say that there is a parity in, and so if they're saying, for example, if you're saying if you have a physical condition and you get a week of in the hospital, well, if you have a psychological condition, you also should be entitled to a week in the hospital. So sort of saying that, let's make those equal. At the same time, it seems like people like you and others who are really concerned about the issue of mental health are really continue to fight just to get, to raise people's awareness about these issues.
Yes. And I do want to point out that to my way of thinking, for there to be a real transformation of the mental health care system, several things have to take place at once, and that's the argument in my book. And I focus on five things. We have to move to a system that's results-oriented by using those outcome measures I was talking about and by using evidence-based practices. We have to move to a system that's innovative, that welcomes new approaches to treatment, that's not monopolistic as it currently tends to be. The system has to be well-funded through parity and other efforts. It has to be consumer-driven. In other words, we have to really elevate the role and position and authority given to those who come to us for care. And it has to be committed to change. And that last part is really key, and that is we have to find ways to overcome the resistance that's built into the status quo. And if you put all those five together, I believe you could hit a tipping point where we will have dramatic, sweeping changes in the mental health system and develop a system of care that we would all be very proud of, where the usual experience would be for someone who comes into the system of care would be that they would, in short order, recover well enough to be able to go home.
Let's take another caller. Champagne, line one. Hello. Is the caller there, line one?
Oh, hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm calling really, maybe this is outside the scope of your book, but it's regarding January 18, 2008, New England Journal of Medicine article about bias in the research on antidepressant therapy, and it was quite alarming in that the research that shows negative or poor results with antidepressants doesn't even get published, doesn't even get considered.
Oh, yeah.
Most of the time. And only the positive studies are published, and it was a whole article that demonstrated that. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but how did that impact your practice?
Yes, I am familiar with the problem, and I think that's fairly alarming to all of us, is that it turns out some of the pharmaceutical companies have sponsored some of the research that has been in the field supporting the effectiveness of certain medications, and obviously that's a terrible issue that we've got to address. We've got to make sure that the scientific data that we refer to are objective, not biased. And in my book, I do point to that, and I just use it for one reason why we've got to be careful not to over-rely on medications. We do tend to do that. I know I had people in my clinic who would come to me who had been on antidepressants for years, and they felt like it was sort of a mood ripener, so to speak, and that it was helping them. The truth of the matter was it wasn't helping them at all after a time, because you develop tolerance to the medication, so it doesn't really do much of anything except give you the same side effects it always did. So I do think there's a tendency for us to over-medicate, and what we should do is pay careful attention to what science shows us is most effective, which is usually a moderate use of medication, in some cases, combined with psychotherapy and other community supports.
There, we must stop. We are here at the end of this first hour of our show. Our guest, Dr. Timothy Kelly, is director of the Dupree Center Public Policy Institute and associate professor of psychology at the Fuller Graduate School of Psychology in Pasadena, California. He's been working in the mental health field for a long time, and if you're interested in reading more of his thoughts, look for the book Healing the Broken Mind, Transforming America's Failed Mental Health System, published by New York University Press. Dr. Kelly, thank you very much.
You're most welcome. All the best.